The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite pieces from the magazine and ask their writers to read them out loud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on the podcast this week, reacting to the recommendations from a recent report exploring the Church of England's role in Africa historically, William Moore asks if the Church is about to apologise for Christianity itself. Sean Thomas recounts his experience tripping on ayahuasca in a remote Colombian province. Matt Ridley argues that private landowners make better conservationists. Lionel Shriver warns against pathological niceness and explains why this is linked to the debate about immigration. And Kate Andrews reviews the new play at the Olivier Theatre about Nye Bevan, starring Michael Sheen as the architect of the NHS. Up first, William Moore.
Is the Church of England going to apologise for Christianity? A report by something called the Oversight Group has declared that the Church should say sorry publicly, not just for profiting from the evils of slavery through investment in the South Sea Company, but for seeking to destroy diverse African traditional religious belief systems. And, having apologised, it recommends the Church reach beyond theological institutions and enable all Africans to discover the varied belief systems and spiritual practices of their forebears and their efficacy. The Oversight Group is an independent committee, but the Church commissioners have warmly welcomed all the report's recommendations, including the suggestions around truth-telling. And for those of us who still love the Church of England, this is both depressing and disturbing. If all beliefs and practices are as good and truthful as each other, if attempts to replace one set of religious ideas with another are wrong, then all African missionary activity is wrong. And some of the bravest modern martyrs, the African Christians who suffered and died for their faith, were misguided. The broadness of the report's spiritual demands has some deeply alarming implications. Surely there are diverse African traditional religious belief systems which the missionaries were right to try to replace. Idolatry, witchcraft, twin infanticide, a practice in southeast Nigeria until it was all but abolished by the Presbyterian missionary Mary Slessor. Cannibalism, human sacrifice, to name some of the most extreme. Michael Nazir Ali, the former Bishop of Rochester, is critical of the report. The way to do it would have been to say, we applaud all the good that was done and is being done today, while acknowledging there were mistakes which need to be put right, he says. But by comparison to the good done, the mistakes are minor. He cites the use of drums in worship as an example of an African practice which it was wrong for missionaries to eradicate. We can now see it's possible to use drums without those pagan associations. But many other very concerning elements of African traditional religions kept people in bondage. No one should apologise for eradicating any of that. Nazir Ali converted to Catholicism 3 years ago precisely because of the C of E's obsession with jumping on every faddish bandwagon about identity politics and mea culpas about Britain's imperial past. If everything is seen from an anti-imperial, anti-colonialist mindset, even the spreading of the gospel can't escape that mindset. Logically, then, you end up apologising for Christianity itself. It has passed by the Oversight Group, an oversight perhaps, that most missionaries opposed slavery. By the 20th century, most missionaries were also African. In 1906, the Church Mission Society had nearly 9,000 missionaries, fewer than 1,000 of them European. The rest were native agents. Samuel Ajayi Crowther, the first African Anglican bishop, and a former slave who converted at 16, brought his own Yoruba translation of the Bible and the Book of Common Prayer to tribes along the Niger River because he saw it as his calling to make all men wise unto salvation and to fight manfully under Christ's banner against spiritual enemies. No one did more to bring West Africa to Anglicanism or to make Anglicanism African. The Reverend R.H. Stone, an American Baptist who nearly died several times on his mission in the 1860s, recounted in his book, In Africa's Forest and Jungle, or 6 Years Among the Yorubans, how in awe he was of the bravery of the African converts turned missionaries. In particular, he wrote of two women converts called Osuntala and Ofiki, who endured the most bitter persecution without a murmur, supporting themselves by their implicit faith in the promises of God. Osuntala was hounded by her village for her faith. Ofiki's husband would often flog her for not participating in pagan practices. One Lord's Day, we noticed an expression of pain on her countenance and inquired what was the matter. She said nothing, but merely lifted her shoulder cloth and exhibited the lacerated flesh. "If I had not already become a Christian," Stone said, "they would have led me to become a disciple." Should the Church of England apologise, using the wording of the report, it would be an insult to the memory of missionaries and converts. What would such an apology say about the Ugandan martyrs, 22 Catholic and 23 Anglican converts, who in the 1880s were executed by King Mwanga II? That they need not have bothered abandoning their old beliefs? That they should have thought harder about efficacy? Today's African Christians may also be surprised to discover that their faith is optional, especially given that of the Christians in the world who were killed for their beliefs, 90% are from Africa. There is a collapse of confidence in Anglicanism within the C of E. The church seems embarrassed by its own existence and by the imperative of spiritual leadership. One retired bishop tells me he once asked the chair of one of the many reports on the future of the church why there was nothing about encouraging priestly vocation, and was told that would be too elitist. The only sliver of hope for Anglicans is that the C of E simply hasn't yet clocked the implications of the recommendations and could back away from them. A C of E spokesman says that the church does not interpret the recommendations as a call to apologise for spreading the gospel. However, we need to be transparent that appalling abuses took place in the past. If the church wants to apologise for abuses, it should, but it has to reject the oversight group's wording, or it will end up undermining its reason for existing. How typical it would be of the Church of England to apologise for Christianity by mistake.
That was William Moore. Next, Sean Thomas.
If you've ever wondered what happened to drug lord Pablo Escobar's enormous cocaine and occasional execution palace, as featured in the Netflix series Narcos, I can tell you. These days, following the violent death of Escobar in 1993 and the consequent escape of his pet hippos from his private zoo, the estate is now a garish, plasticky, hippo-themed children's water park called Hacienda Napoles. I have just driven past it. I am deep in the Colombian province of Antioquia. Until about 6 years ago, this hilly, jungly, notably remote region, halfway between the capital Bogota and the once murderous cartel citadel of Medellin, was strictly off limits thanks to Escobar and friends, alongside revolutionary guerrilla outfits, militias, and kidnapping gangs. Happily, much of that violence has receded, even as Pablo's feral coke hippos have multiplied. They are now regarded as a pest and sometimes wander into local towns. This means tourism has returned via guest houses and quaint resorts and boho-delic lodges dedicated to the legal ingestion of the Amazonian drug known as ayahuasca, yahe, or the sacred vine. Ayahuasca is the most powerful psychedelic found in nature. It is known for making you puke, sob, howl, and crap yourself. That's if it doesn't send you into a delusional spiritual meltdown, culminating in psychosis or even death. Never mix it with SSRIs like Prozac. So why do it? Because the best ayahuasca induces wild spiritual revelations accompanied by exquisite visual hallucinations. That's why people from across the world come to take it in its Amazonian homeland. That is why I am here, and why I have been joined by a motley but compelling crew of American tech bros, a notable neuroscientist, amusing Hackney artists, inquisitive local coffee barons, beautiful girls from Seoul and Berlin, a New York computer wizard, two Anglo-Danish filmmakers, a guy in a feathered Sikh turban, and the granddaughter of a famous Spanish novelist. Plus a brace of Eurasian high priestesses who seem to serve the whims of the main man, the tribal shaman, the ayahuasquero. The ayahuasquero is an important figure, and our guy is one of the best. He is simultaneously the conductor, wizard, and medicine man. He's the one who will sense if we are about to go schizo and salvage us with a waft of burning sage or a mouthful of mambe, a green powder of coca leaves which tastes like vile dry flour but is oddly addictive. Alternatively, if he detects that one of us is not getting the buzz, he will offer a more potent dish of huasca, then some San Pedro mescaline, then several hours in a sweat lodge. I've done ayahuasca once before, so I am not signed on for the whole deal. I know how challenging it can be. One dose will easily be enough. Indeed, I'm quite scared. Everyone is scared before they take ayahuasca. The ceremony in a wooden hilltop pyramid begins after nightfall. The fire is set. Songs are sung. We drink the cup of bittersweet yaje and settle back in slightly uncomfortable chairs around the psychonautical pyramid. After 30 minutes of vague warbling and silent fire gazing, I check my watch and wonder if the drugs are duds. It happens. After another hour of nothing, I think this is pointless and look at my watch again and realize that, in reality, only a minute has passed. Temporal dilation is one of the first symptoms of ayahuasca intoxication. Now the yaje kicks in. My hands suddenly seem to be made of tungsten. Also, they are emitting yellow and violet sparks, and a lattice of crimson Incan motifs is forming to my left. When I look at the burning fire, I notice it is levitating up to the ceiling. A delicately luminous moth alights on my arm and smirks at me. My lepidopterology is rusty, but smirking seems unusual. At this point, the guilt comes knocking. This is a traditional part of the ayahuasca trip, when you go over your lifelong litany of failures, doubts, and cruelties, and it often leads to a terrible self-reckoning. But just as I am sinking into remorse, I look down and realize I'm floating over an Aztec temple made of hexagonal sapphires. The hallucinations are back, but they are so intense I can barely take notes. At one point I wonder why I am yawning so much. At another, I write down the important lesson, "Whoa, that looks weird, don't look at it," which is possibly a good motto for life. Later on I write, "At least I haven't shat myself yet." Another handy lifetime motto. Finally, and with relief tinged with regret, I realise the hallucinations are ebbing away. The spiralling vortices of light have become sparkles of receding stars. The enigmatic moth has gone. It's been brilliant, scary, wonderful, and I never want to do it again. Probably. All I desire is to go back to my room and drink Malbec. If only I could walk. but I'm too wobbly. A nice chap guides me down the moonlit hill to my jungly room, which overlooks a rainforest cascade. As I go, I realised I've had another extraordinary ayahuasca experience, but it's been different to last time. Tonight, I had way more hallucinations, yet maybe not so many chats with God. Of those I had, you probably wouldn't want to hear them. It's like listening to other people's dreams. All I can say is that he is surprisingly unfussed by climate change. Nonetheless, I have learned one quite important thing. Everything is funny. Even death, however sad, tragic, or cruel, is funny. This might sound heartless, and you should generally not laugh aloud, but it is also importantly true. Death is maybe especially funny, because it makes a poetic and comedic mockery of us all. And if I need proof of that, I can walk 10 minutes up the dappled forest path to the one-time home of Pablo Escobar, who became the richest man on earth and the most feared man in Colombia, and whose sole memorial is a gaudy kiddies water park complete with hippo-shaped coffee shacks.
That was Sean Thomas. Next, Matt Ridley.
The Duke of Norfolk is best known for presiding over the coronation as hereditary Earl Marshal. But what really gets him excited is a native farmland bird, the grey partridge. Nearly 20 years ago, he was appalled to learn from the veteran ecologist Dick Potts that the species was down to its last three pairs on his estate in Sussex and about to go extinct. He decided to do something about it. Today, the Peppering estate has around 300 pairs of partridges, as well as corn buntings, lapwings, rare butterflies, long-lost cornfield flowers, and other wildlife. Last year, the Duke brought curlew eggs south from the Pennines and hatched them off to try to re-establish the species on the South Downs. This story is told in a charming new book, Return of the Grey Partridge, by Roger Morgan Grenfell and Eddie Norfolk, and is an example of a new trend for private landowners to do pioneering conservation work on a scale that often dwarfs and sometimes shames the wildlife conservation charities that get more media attention. Philip Merricks is another example. He inherited a large arable farm at Elmley on the Isle of Sheppey, but when it was designated as a site of special scientific interest 43 years ago, because of its importance for breeding lapwings and redshank, he was offered compensation only for the things he was not going to be allowed to do, rather than for doing anything positive for conservation. He pestered the government, saying, "If you want me to farm lapwings instead of corn, I can do so, but you have to let me do it actively." After a lot of discussion with those who thought he should just go on farming, but badly, he won support to do it his way. By digging scrapes, managing water levels, controlling crows and foxes, excluding badgers, and grazing cattle at the right times, he has steadily built up the lapwing population to an astounding 350 pairs, and the redshanks to 400, alongside scores of other rare breeding birds. In May, as I can attest, Elmley is an avian Serengeti. In winter, it holds more than 25,000 widgeon and more than 100 harriers. In 2010, independent monitors calculated that while Elmley's lapwings were producing 1.33 chicks per pair per year, the lapwings on the neighbouring land, run by the Royal Society for the Protection of Birds, were producing just 0.11 chicks per pair per year, not enough to replace adult deaths. One reserve was a population source, the other a population sink. Eventually, the RSPB turned the management of their patch over to Merricks. Merricks enlisted the ornithologist Professor Ian Newton to argue that for ground-nesting birds, Conventional environmental policies focused on habitat improvement but not predation control were, and still are, worse than doing nothing. They create an ecological trap by luring lapwings to good habitat, where their eggs and chicks are gobbled up by crows and foxes year after year. Like Peppering, Elmley is now incubating and releasing young curlews, with the hope that they will return to breed successfully. Then there is Holcombe, the estate of the Earl of Leicester in North Norfolk. Its 8 miles of coast and extensive salt marshes were always a magnet for geese, ducks and wading birds. In the mid-1800s, the second Earl of Leicester created a sanctuary for the geese. But when the marshes were declared a National Nature Reserve in 1967, a succession of government agencies took over and focused on passively protecting rather than actively encouraging the wildlife. Frustrated by this, in 2012, Lord Leicester did not renew Natural England's lease, believing his team could do a better job of managing the nature reserve. The Quango's panjandrums were gobsmacked by this impertinence, arguing that the estate lacked qualified staff and would ruin the place. Instead, under the leadership of the former gamekeeper and writer Jake Fiennes, Holcombe National Nature Reserve has seen a steady increase in the number of birds both wintering and breeding. Vast and growing numbers of pink-footed geese and widgeon use the reserve in winter, as I saw in January. While in summer, the number of breeding cormorants, herons, little egrets, marsh harriers, oyster catchers, avocets and bearded tits have all increased. They were joined in 2016 by great white egrets, and in 2019 by cattle egrets. Rarest of all, the number of spoonbills fledged on the reserve has increased from 10 in 2010 to 90 in 2023. This is their first and largest British breeding site. The reserve attracts about 1 million visitors a year, whose car parking fees and donations help pay for the conservation work. Together with income from cattle grazing and grants, the estate has made conservation into a commercially respectable, though not lucrative, proposition. There are two features that Leicester, Merricks and Norfolk bring to the management of their land that differ from the way wildlife trusts or the RSPB manage their reserves. The first is the scale of active intervention. These are not purist rewilders who see their role as getting human beings out of the way of nature. They dig scrapes, plant hedges, graze cattle, alter water levels, sow crops for pollinators and bird feed, and generally interfere. So do some NGO conservation charities, but usually with less determination and enthusiasm. The second difference is the scale of predator control. Again, some NGOs do this, but usually with reluctance, and they try not to talk about it. Private sector conservationists, by contrast, work day and night during the spring and early summer to rid their land of as many crows, foxes, stoats and rats as possible, knowing that anything less than zero tolerance is disastrous for ground nesting birds. Predator control would probably not be necessary if Britain were a pristine wilderness, but in a world where human activity subsidises these animals, it is vital. The five gamekeepers at Peppering, for instance, have a target to kill 200 rats each during the spring, and it is a Sisyphean task. Not all landowners are so green-tinged, but nor are these the only aristocrats doing private conservation. A healthy rivalry is driving others to keep up with the Howards. The Duke of Northumberland's fields between Alnwick and the coast are now swarming with wild partridges, finches, buntings, thrushes, larks, barn owls and hares, even in winter. In Dorset, Viscount Cranbourne counts the corn buntings and turtle doves thriving alongside his growing population of partridges. In the Pennines, we grouse moor owners produce healthy surpluses every year of some of the country's rarest birds, merlins, curlews, dunlins, golden plover and black grouse, among others. These species are absent, or very rare, on hills that are not managed for grouse shooting, most of the Lake District and Wales, for example. In Wensleydale, Lord Bolton has become a passionate champion of the curlew, organising events for the public to see and hear the hundreds of pairs that nest on his moor. Some conservationists complain that birds of prey are not so welcome on these moors, but this is increasingly out of date. In the past 10 years, the number of fledged hen harrier chicks in England has gone from 0 to 141, and most of these were born on grouse moors. In Nidderdale, the Earl of Swinton welcomes visitors to a special hide to photograph roosting harriers. Managing the numbers of these birds before they destroy the very system that enables them to thrive is now an urgent issue. The contrast between these moors and those owned by the RSPB has not gone unnoticed. In his book Moorland Matters, Ian Coghill, former chairman of the Game and Wildlife Conservation Trust, lambasts the RSPB for its management of Lake Vyrnwy, a Welsh moor that was once thick with curlew, merlin and black grouse, but where all three species are now teetering on the brink of extinction. Coghill points out that the very failure of these birds to thrive is then effectively weaponised by the society in its fundraising. In asking for £3,299,900 from the Heritage Lottery Fund, the RSPB threatened that without the money, quotes, curlew, black grouse and merlin will cease to appear as a breeding species in this area of Wales, end quotes. Of course, there is one big difference between privately run conservation projects and those run by NGOs. Many of the private sector conservationists also like to shoot birds. The Duke of Norfolk makes no secret that one of his motives in restoring the grey partridge was to generate a surplus of birds that could then be shot for sport. Likewise, most Pennine Moor owners are only curlew farming, as the BBC presenter Chris Packham derisively puts it, as a by-product of encouraging red grouse to shoot. Yet the red grouse is Britain's most unique bird, and conserving it at private expense to the point of abundance is in itself a triumph of active conservation. Private landowners own vastly more acres than NGOs, so any policy to help nature recover necessarily requires their involvement. A scattering of NGO-owned and taxpayer-funded islands of diversity will not be enough. Yet when the government or its quangos draw up new rules, they talk mostly to the NGOs and think mostly of how to stop bad landowners doing bad things, rather than working with good landowners to do good things. The Duke of Norfolk tells a funny if exasperated story about how much easier he found it to get the monarch and even the Pope to return his calls than the official within Natural England in charge of permitting him to release curlews.
That was Matt Ridley. Now Lionel Shriver.
When so many polls suggest that restricting mass immigration would be to politicians' electoral advantage, voters in the West are continually stymied by why the immoderate flow of foreigners into their countries continues apace. Online comments abound with theories. A global World Economic Forum-led cabal is intent on eliminating the nation-state by fracturing polities into mutually hostile subgroups, making them easier to control. An atomized infighting rabble would seem rather harder to control, but maybe that's just me. In the U.S., Democrats are intentionally importing minorities who will supposedly all vote Democratic and usher in a one-party state. If so, an iffy plan. Minorities are steadily drifting Republican. In the U.K., Britain's elites despise their own country and hope to destroy it from the inside. In both countries, black and brown peoples are seen as morally superior, So the plan is to replace the bedraggled, racist white remnants of native-born populations with the righteous ranks of the oppressed, and thereby rectify historical wrongs. Western governments are in cahoots with big business to deliver a ceaseless supply of cheap labor and to depress domestic wages. In previous columns, I've mooted to additional theories. One, fecklessness. Governments don't constrain immigration because they don't know how. And two, pathological niceness. Remarks earlier this year by the head of Frontex, the EU's border and coast guard agency, might inform this discussion. To put it bluntly, the Dutchman Hans Legens told an interviewer from Germany's Die Welt, nothing can stop people from crossing a border. No wall, no fence, no sea, no river. Sometimes it's pretended that you can just put a lid on top of the bottle, and then the migration stops. But that's a misconception. To paraphrase, the man since last spring in charge of securing Europe's borders, the porousness of which has a direct knock-on effect on Britain's small boats problem, does not believe in the possibility of securing any border. It's not hard to infer from that quote that our friend Hans does not believe it is possible to prevent so much as a single gatecrasher from entering the EU, or from entering any country, for that matter. Yet, this is his job. It's as if you have just hired a fry cook to flip burgers, and though your new employee proves happy to accept a salary, he promptly declares that he will not be flipping any burgers because he does not believe there's such a thing as a hamburger. I regard that interview as one vote for fecklessness. Hans cheerfully throws up his hands. There's nothing to be done. We can't keep anybody out. We don't know how. I imagine Hans must greatly enjoy his work, providing, as it does, so much leisure time. Yet further on, the festively feeble Frontex exec tips his hand. Who am I to condemn migrants? He declares. This talk of stopping people and closing borders can't be our narrative all the time. My job is to strike a balance between effective border management and respect for fundamental rights. Presumably, fundamental rights, such as the inherent prerogative of everyone from everywhere in the world to live in your country because they don't like theirs. Helpless Hans wants to address the whole European migration debate with, quote, increased humanity, less fear of the unknown, less prejudice. In other words, the head of Frontex has a vested interest in his absolute incapacity to keep anyone out of Europe, because he doesn't especially want to keep anyone out of Europe. He doesn't want to do his job because that job is mean and bad. He wants to be soft and warm and cuddly and kind. This is what I mean by pathological niceness. At the beginning of his term, Joe Biden lifted all Trump's policies for controlling America's southern border because those policies were not nice. They sometimes slammed the door in the faces of perfectly pleasant people who, if they didn't get their shot at the American dream, would be disappointed. Now, after 3.5 years of all that rampant niceness, large Democratic cities are overwhelmed by those perfectly pleasant people, some of whom are running moped mugging gangs and shoplifting rings. And Biden could lose the coming election because of his lovey-dovey border policies alone. Again, why is this happening? I simply can't weigh in on some WEF conspiracy to subjugate the whole world and ensure we'll all be happy and own nothing. There may be something to that cheap labor theory, Though low-skilled imports cost the public purse so much more than they save selective industries through depressed wages, that for government, the big picture doesn't add up. I don't see why even elites would want to destroy a country in which they still live. Frankly, I'd be relieved if Biden Democrats were ushering millions of unvetted, poorly educated aliens into the U.S. to grow their electoral base, because at least that would indicate a deliberate strategy from which some faction is perceived to benefit. I prefer such calculating deviousness to lobotomized naivete. But the right-on activist lawyers who make a tidy taxpayer-funded living from tying immigration proceedings in knots, gormless NGO staffers whose salaries are often funded by the very governments whose meager efforts to impose limits on inflows these worthies are pledged to thwart, UN sinecures whose agencies unembarrassedly promote the view that all migration is an unqualified good, left-wing bureaucrats and politicians, including Huggable Hans, the UK Home Office, and more than half of today's Tory MPs. The lot of them? Do not believe in restricting immigration at all, full stop. Pathological niceness wins the day. Fecklessness plays a part, but the fecklessness is convenient. This is a problem not of conniving, but of conviction, that there's no such thing as too much immigration. We keep searching for a hidden agenda, but imputing a covert, ulterior motive to these folks gives them too much credit. They want to flood our countries with foreigners, because they want to flood our countries with foreigners. Mystery solved.
That was Lionel Shriver. Finally, Kate Andrews.
A Judy Garland rendition. Dancing Nurses. A star lead. No spectacle is spared in Tim Price's new play, Nye, which tells the story of Aniran Bevan, the architect of the National Health Service. The drama opens with Bevan being cared for on an NHS ward, slipping in and out of consciousness, on the brink of death. For the nearly 3 hours that follow, his sickness and his morphine drip plunge him into his deepest memories, portrayed as a Welsh fantasia that tells the story of his life and his creation. Welsh heavyweight Michael Sheen takes on one of the most notable Welsh politicians in modern British history. He captures Bevan at every stage of life. The schoolboy who is abused by his headmaster and struggles with a stutter, the socialist activist, the coal miner, the Labour MP, and finally, the health and housing minister under Clement Attlee, who transforms the health service. The playfulness and slight nervousness Sheen brings to the role is convincing in Bevan's earlier years. His wide-eyed wonder is particularly moving in a library sequence when he works to overcome his stutter. The attributes start to feel strained in Bevan's later life, standing up to Winston Churchill during the war and battling with the doctors' unions when launching the NHS, not helped by the wardrobe department insisting Sheen walks around barefoot and wears pajamas throughout. But Sheen, despite a commanding performance, is the second biggest star in this National Theatre production. The main character is the system itself, the idea, the dream of the NHS, which is presented only as a positive development. Strange, then, that this dream often comes across as a nightmare. Yes, the staging is designed to be surreal. Suspension of disbelief is pushed to its maximum when Sheen starts to sing Get Happy, while patients and doctors break into dance, reminiscent of the NHS tribute in the opening ceremony of the 2012 Olympics. Sometimes it's pushed past its limits. There's a ratio of at least one doctor or nurse per NHS patient. Fresh flowers are placed next to every NHS bed. But the surreal often strays into the sinister. The fluorescent green-tinted lights feel claustrophobic. The ambulance sirens and frequent unexplained crashing and banging keep you on edge. The scene at the start of the second act, with a single bed centered under vast strip lights, looks better suited to a production of 1984. The attempt to draw a contrast between Bevan's father's death, which happens before universal access to healthcare is introduced, and his own fails badly. The former is violent, the latter is a dance, yet both are eerie. Nye is not a nuanced play. The portrayal of heroes and villains borders on panto. When a figure who opposes the NHS tries to smother someone who supports it with a pillow, you could hear giggling in the audience. In one exchange between Bevan and Churchill, the show's bad guy, Bevan insists no one dares say anything because everyone worships you like a god. The parallel to the modern deification of the NHS is striking but never acknowledged. The production doubles down on the veneration at the end with a list of NHS achievements projected onto the stage. For a play supposedly centered on the creation of the NHS, it's odd that the formation is only covered in the final third. But the idea is always present. Hospital beds serve as school benches and podiums in local council halls. The waves of the electrocardiogram outline the coal mines, an allegory, if there ever was one, for how the NHS has come to dominate politics and personal lives since Bevan founded it 76 years ago. A lot of the audience, dozens of whom are statistically very likely to be on a waiting list themselves right now, will see this clearly. Those in the production seem far less aware.
And that's everything for this week. If you enjoyed those articles, why not pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine to read them and many more in full? I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.